You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 14th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly dose of cultural opinion here on Monocle 24, broadcasting from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, a thespian theme. Jude Law and Sarah Jessica Parker take to the stage in London and New York. Our friend Matt Wolfe will be here to guide us through the latest productions, including the stage version of American Psycho.
Should I try on these mod frisons? You can't go wrong, though. With Ferragamo.
And later on, we'll cross to Melbourne to hear what's on offer in the city.
So you've gone from having an impressionist master to having, like I say, ping pong tables in the foyer or an architectural structure made of $3 IKEA bins.
Art Basel, Miami Beach drew to a close last weekend, so now that the sand has settled, what to make of this year's event? We'll put that question to writer and curator Francesca Gavin.
Plus, a cultural guide to the weekend in Tokyo, our weekly dose of music today courtesy of Tim Chipping from Fruits magazine, and our San Francisco correspondent's take on David Hockney's exhibition in the city.
In their careful attention to nature, there is something in these pictures of Henry David Thoreau, or the Lake District poems of William Wordsworth.
An international selection to get your teeth into, coming up right here on The Review on Monocle 24.
So a busy programme to look forward to today. Gillian DeBias, so you are just back from your travels from Prague, where you have made a very beautiful film about toys.
I've been reviewing toys, handcrafted toys. We decided for our Christmas film this year to go to one of the heart of the toy-making countries of traditional toys. We love our wooden toys here at Monocle. And the Czechs have an amazing tradition that, you know, not many but a few craftsmen and collectors are still holding on to. And they're kind of not just for children. Of course, toys are made for children and the imagination of children. But they are so beautifully made and a little bit dark. So the beauty of these is that they also have great appeal for collectors, adult collectors of toys.
They have tremendous character. It was astonishing to watch the film because it drew out the fact that during the communist era, all this was banned. And yet the tradition has just emerged so fruitfully since that it's really impressive.
And wonderfully, like during the communist tradition, they weren't really threatened by puppet shows, which they should have been, because of course there's all the, you know, a satire and allegory in puppet shows, but they weren't. So puppet making continued in its small ways as travelling theatre groups, hand-carved, and that kept that whole tradition of puppets and toy making on. So it's a bit of a social history, and it's also just a beautiful toy story.
It is. It's a delightful thing when you go to Prague that you see the toy shops, and it's lovely to see people go in them. And when I have friends who come back from Prague, they do tend to bring me a toy, and it is just a lovely thing to have something very unique in your house. It makes a huge change from the horror of other toys.
When you see, like, I'm horrified when I see children on planes and trains and automobiles on their screens, young children on screens, and you just think, take that screen away and give them a lovely little wooden toy that rattles.
And not on a plane, no, not a rattling toy on a plane, certainly not. Let's talk theatre.
It is sellout season in Theatreland, and London is embracing the trend for big-ticket names to tread the boards. It's bringing new audiences and showcasing some interesting new directors. It's also offering a whole new challenge to audiences, namely, how do you get a ticket?
And who better to guide us through London's current offerings with opinion and wit, but review regular Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times. Welcome as ever, Matt. Good to have you in the studio.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
We have a really good meaty choice of plays to get through today.
I
don't think I've actually seen a list that I've thought, yeah, I want to see all of them.
Yes, well,
do we begin?
We could begin with Shakespeare or with musicals. I have to say it's the busiest December I can remember. Interestingly, in New York, December goes very quiet as far as new openings, whereas London, everything is just going full pelt. It's quite astonishing. And it isn't just seasonal entertainment. It's stuff that you would want to see any time of the year.
Why do you think that is?
Well, a lot of it is scheduling. If you're Tom Hiddleston, who's much in demand as a Hollywood A-lister now, I guess, and he wants to do Coriolanus at the Donmar, you do it when he can do it. Jude Law is finishing a 5-play season At the Noel Coward Theatre. He's playing Henry V. These are five plays, all programmed by the same director. This was intended for the end, so that if it's a big hit, it can move to New York. So there are all sorts of things that come into play.
There is that trouble, though, that I experienced today, much to my frustration, is that you can't buy a ticket for any of this.
It's really hard at theatres like the Donmar. I mean, you know, they are in a way victims of their own success. I don't think actually they've probably had an empty seat or an unsold seat. Somebody might not show up, but an unsold seat for a very, very long time. So what people do is then they become friends, so they get to go earlier with advanced tickets, or then ultra friends, and then they can book even earlier. And it reaches a point where there's no reason and to open it to the general public because they can't get in.
The Donmar does that thing on a Monday morning where you hover over your laptop at 10 a.m. and they release front row tickets.
Yes.
It never works. And there's this sort of great problem that of trying to bring accessibility to the audience, but at the same time making it just impossible to get a seat.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to hear you say this, Emma, because I don't think theatre critics actually reflect often enough on how lucky we are, not just to, you know, have seats, but to have good seats at performances that, you know, we want to go to.
The beauty of it is, though, you have small theatres like the Donmar or the Almeida, which is going to be the topic of our first play, that are small enough that you're close enough to the actors. And if you're committed enough, you go and fight for those tickets. Tell us about the production at the Almeida.
Well, and if you're Matt Smith, who's given, I think, a dazzling performance as Patrick Bateman at the Almeida in the musical premiere of American Psycho, you can take advantage of the fact that the Almeida only seats 325. Mm-hmm. And on occasion, I don't know if he did this the night you went, but the night I went, and I gather this does happen a fair amount, he will occasionally interact with the audience. So, for instance, somebody sneezes, he turns and acknowledges it. Not in a way that is disconcerting or kind of coy, but just we're all in a very tight space. You might as well acknowledge that.
Yeah.
I thought American Psycho was terrific, and I have to say, expectations in the theater exist to be confounded. This was a classic case of me thinking in advance, I don't know, it's going to be very glib, it's going to be very, brand name intensive, it's going to be a blank treatment of societal blankness, and that actually wears thin after about 10 minutes. But what I hadn't counted on was that there's real substance and grit here. And I also didn't realize that Matt Smith had the acting chops that he has to make Patrick Bateman not just a sort of avatar of soullessness, but something, there's something within him that he's fighting. You feel throughout the entire performance this kind of push me, pull you. He's drawn to slaughter, but at the same time, he wants to stop himself and he just can't.
American Psycho, the book, I remember when it came out and reading it and not quite getting it, and then having to go back about 10 years later and read it and think, my goodness, this was the first really serious critique of branding, of a world that we'd all fallen into, the soulless sort of the love of the brand, the obsession with brands. It's a very cold and very detached and very, very bloody book, and the last piece of work I had ever thought would translate into a musical. How do they do it successfully?
Well, they do it by Rupert Gould as the director, who now runs the Almeida, I think it's important to say. So this is an important kind of clarion call for his Almeida regime. They do it largely by finding a kind of realism which isn't exactly real. So the whole thing, you wouldn't call it surreal, but it's slightly at a sidelong angle from reality, just as Patrick Bateman is at a sidelong angle from the world he inhabits. And there's a very interesting suggestion in the show, come the finale, which I won't give away, that in a way, it doesn't really matter who Patrick Bateman is. He could be any of us. He doesn't really get a comeuppance in the show. And the suggestion at the end is that the Patrick Batemans of the world walk amongst us. Well, that's absolutely true. All you need to do is read the newspaper on a daily basis, and you read these sort of horrific stories about men and women who are Patrick Batemans in everything but name.
The American Psycho is probably meant to be one of the most... It's horror. It's gore. I found the musical very funny. Very funny. But funny because it was clever in that it was reflecting a decade that had so much in it to reflect.
Yes, and it's funny because it acknowledges the absurdity of what it's acknowledging. So, for instance, there's a thing about, you know, let's peer into the existential abyss while we're shopping at Bloomingdale's. So you get the brand name reference, but you also get something about the absolute sort of terror, the psychic terror at the heart of it. Matt Smith is no singer, but even his lack of vocal kind of skill works for the part. There's something other about him, which is exactly what the part needs.
Let's have a listen.
Chanel, Cartier, or Giorgio Armani, Moschino, Alaya, or Norma Kamali. Should I rock the Betsy Johnson, or stick with classic Comme des Garçons? In a certain kind of neighborhood, you might get away.
The sound of a wonderful track from American Psycho, which
both
has
of you
just
dancing there.
Opened at the Alameda. It was there. The music was interesting because it's so important to the book and the character of Bateman, the soundtrack. And they used it very well in original songs, but also in new poppy, very synced renditions.
Well, what's interesting is there are about five or six, I don't know exactly, songs from the period by Tears for Fears, Huey Lewis and the News, one of my absolute favorites.
Phil Collins.
Yeah, Phil Collins.
You're betraying a lot there by saying that.
I'm so sorry. But, you know, it's Christmas. Let's be honest. And then you have this original score by Duncan Sheik, American songwriter, who's best known in the theater world for his superb musical, A Spring Awakening, which was on Broadway and in the West End. And it's sort of like the best score the Depeche Mode or Giorgio Moroder never quite got around to writing. It's very heavy on the beat. It doesn't have a lot of affect. It's not something you're probably going to sing to the kids, but it's absolutely right for the soundscape of the show.
And didn't you think the dancing was amazing? It's like they looked at all archive footage of 80s discos.
Yes.
And you have this incredible ensemble cast dancing to the music in just such an 80s way.
I'm really glad you mentioned this incredible ensemble cast, because a lot of the press, inevitably, but you know, given Matt Smith's star power from Doctor Who and whatnot, has been all about him, and he's terrific, but it's an absolutely superb ensemble. There's a trio of women who play the different people in Patrick Bateman's orbit who might be next for the chop, literally. Particularly an extraordinary performance by somebody I've never heard of before called Cassandra Compton, who plays his secretary, Jean, who's kind of the innocent of the piece, and you feel, Patrick, if there's a chink in his sadistic armor, it's with regard to Jean, and their relationship is quite tremendously drawn.
Let's move on to another play with almost quite strikingly similar themes, an uber-successful man, sexually ambiguous and incredibly bloody, Coriolanus.
Well, Coriolanus hasn't opened yet,
hasn't
so I haven't
yet.
Seen it. But that doesn't stop me from reviewing it.
Of course.
What's interesting is timing. Timing is everything in the theater. Here you have Tom Hiddleston playing the title role in Coriolanus at the Donmar, seating capacity 251. And it is opening hot on the heels of Jude Law's Henry V, which I have seen.
Which again is uber successful man,
right.
Violent and sexually ambiguous.
And Tom Hiddleston, as people may remember, played Henry V on television not long ago in that sequence known as The Hollow Crown. So it's that interesting thing that really keeps kind of British culture percolating away, where you feel like roles are constantly being handed on. It's like a classical theater relay race. Mm. And it's like, okay, Jude Law, Tom Hiddleston, go! And, you know. And
it was done about 2 decades ago with Kenneth Branagh, who hoovered everything up.
Yes.
And there hasn't been a big Henry V since, has they? Who brought that area of Shakespeare to such prominence.
Well, somebody said, it was probably Michael Billington in The Guardian, because he's very scholarly about this, that there hadn't actually been a Henry V on the West End, I mean, commercially, since something like 1938. I mean, London being London, Ed Hall, Peter Hall's son, has a wonderful all-male company called Propeller. They did a terrific Henry V a few years ago. The Globe did one with Jamie Parker. This one is very good. Again, interesting expectations. I hadn't been wild about Jude Law's Hamlet a couple years ago, which I thought was very pictorial and kind of vacuous. And so I thought, oh dear, I don't know about his Henry V. But he's actually lovely in it. And what's unexpected about it, for all the military derring do and whatnot, is at the end of the play, when Henry has, you know, all the battles have come and gone, there's a wonderful scene in which he has to woo the young Princess Catherine.
And he's terrible.
I loved him in that scene.
Well, Henry is terrible.
Oh, Henry's
speak French.
Oh, okay. But he's one. Did you see it?
I did, and it's delightful.
I think he does it charmingly and very sweet. And that's not something you normally think about in relation to Jude Law. Sweet is not a word that comes up a lot.
It's a good role for him, because Henry V has to be a bit of a movie star. Obviously, he has to lead his troops into battle in Agincourt, something that arguably he doesn't have to do in Hamlet, that he'd be too introspective. But if he's a poster boy, probably on the upper limit of age, I'd say. But he's Jude Law seems right for this role.
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, Henry V is referred to as a star of England. So if you're going to cast somebody in the role, why not cast a star of England? And this is about the last year or two that Jude Law can comfortably get away with it, which he knows. And he pulls it off very well. I also thought he was in very, very good voice, better voice than he was in his Hamlet. And that's probably just through kind of seasoning.
He has amazing movement. That was the biggest thing that surprised me when I saw him on stage, is his body language is incredible.
He's also a very gracious theater performer. And I think it's worth pointing out that he's not one of these people who, you know, talented Mr. Ripley on screen and then, oh yeah, I'll see if I can do a play. Long before talented Mr. Ripley, he was in things at the Pit, at the Barbican. He was at the National. He's a stage boy who's found renown on screen, like Tom Hiddleston, like all of these people.
Not just a pretty face, Jude Law.
Not just a pretty face.
Matt Wolfe, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson. Time now to canvass the opinion of one of our own today. Monocle San Francisco correspondent Alistair G reviews David Hockney's triumphant return to California. Here now, his review of A Bigger Exhibition at De Young Museum in San Francisco.
David Hockney's show at the De Young Museum in San Francisco is titled A Bigger Exhibition. And this is partly owing to its size. There are more than 300 works on display, ranging from paintings to iPad drawings and films. It's the kind of exhibition you'll need to visit twice. The title is also a reference to Hockney's iconic 1967 picture, A Bigger Splash, showing a spray of water above a swimming pool after someone has jumped in. With two palm trees against a blue California sky. Hockney, a Yorkshireman, has of course spent many years in the Golden State, and this show is being heralded as his triumphant return. But his pictures of California are not what stand out here. Stealing the spotlight are his works illustrating the changing seasons in Northern England, which he painted en plein air. Several paintings, for instance, show a spot called the Tunnel, a clump of trees with their branches interlocking above a rutted country path. In winter, the trees are bare and the ground is white. But in summer, the scene is alive with electric pinks and oranges, and there are candy floss clouds in the distance. In their careful attention to nature, there is something in these pictures of Henry David Thoreau or the Lake District poems of William Wordsworth.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils beside the lake beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze.
One of the most hypnotic parts of the exhibition is a space enclosed by video screens on four sides. On each screen, there is a film of the same patch of forest in a different season. The cameras moving through the landscape slowly and with grace. There are glinting snowflakes in a colder month and luxuriant greens in spring. And I found myself astonished that one scene could change so much over the course of 365 days, that a tree or a path has so many different incarnations and manifestations. With this show at the De Young, Hockney imparts a sense of wonder at even innocuous corners of the natural world. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
Thanks, Alistair. All sounds lovely. Up next, we review music with Fruits. And to help us do that, we're joined in the studio by another intrepid musical explorer, Tim Chipping. He's a singer, journalist, and in his own words, a surprisingly hardcore folky for a man with such skinny trousers. We have checked, they're skinny-ish.
Yeah. Although I have to correct you, it's F-roots.
F-roots.
Otherwise our editor will explode.
I'm sorry.
He's very particular about that.
I'm very glad that you clarified it. So it's F-roots.
He used to say folk roots, and then when he realised that folk had absolutely no meaning whatsoever anymore, it got shortened to F-roots.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, you put an ear across music from around the world with F-Root.
Yes.
What have you found? What is it? Where is folk at the moment? I mean, I'm going to do it. I'm going to mention that the M-word of that band that just seemed to have taken over the world. Mumford seems to have brought folk to the masses, but perhaps in the wrong way.
I don't think they've done anything of the kind. I think they brought acoustic music to the masses, which has now been called folk because people like that word. It didn't used to be a word that people liked. People were appalled by that word and embarrassed by it, and now they're not. That's just the way things go. But I think the word is kind of meaningless because Gary Barlow's new single, he actually described it as folky.
Right.
So we can't really use that word and not kind of cringe. It's, you know, what I listen to is traditional music. I don't think the word folk really describes anything that I listen to.
Because I was going to say, you know, F-roots. So what, when you say it's not folk roots, do you describe folk
I think it's relevant within the traditional music community. We know what we're talking about when we say it, but just as I imagine a fan of Chuck Berry who uses the phrase R&B doesn't refer to that Chris Brown or R. Kelly as R&B, even though they would be described that in a record shop if it still existed.
When you're trying to bring more people into the kind of music that you listen to.
I try not to, actually. Try and keep them away.
Right. Should we just end this conversation? well, despite that, we're going to make you introduce some music to us. But when you are doing that, do you sometimes find it difficult to try to explain to people what kind of music that they're listening to?
It's really difficult. And I, you know, in the office I work in at the moment, people ask me what I've been doing over the weekend. And I just dread it because it's really difficult to describe where traditional music is and what that really means now. It conjures up all manner of strange images, I think, for people who don't know.
Well, probably best then to listen to it. So we're going to have a listen to our first track, and then we'll ask you to talk a little bit about it and why you brought it to our attention. The first track is The Furrow Collection, Our Captain Calls.
My own dearest jewel, so stay at home. When I had gold in store, you used to invite me. But now I'm low and poor, you seem to slight me.
Furrow Collective there, Our Captain Calls, the choice of Tim Chipping, singer, journalist and columnist at F-Roots magazine. That's a lovely, lovely sound there. Who is the Furrow Collective and where has this song come from?
Well, the Furrow Collective is Emily Portman, Lucy Farrell, Rachel Newton and Alistair Roberts. The first three names might have been familiar to people who've seen the Emily Portman trio been playing over the last few years. And Emily Portman has rightfully gained a lot of praise for making records which sound traditional but are quite often her own songs, which draw from the kind of darker and more deathly elements of folklore and fairy tales. And Alistair Roberts, incredible Scottish traditional singer and guitar player who's kind of been on the sort of outskirts of music for a very long time and not really embraced by the kind of mainstream traddy community until now, really. He's kind of been brought into this project, and I don't really like the word collective because I kind of believe in pop groups and I like them to have snappy names that you can write in your pencil case. But this is a project they've worked on, all traditional songs. That one, probably people know the tune for that song more than they know the words. It was collected by Vaughan Williams. And it was called Welcome Sailor, I think, when he collected it. But he used the tune for Bunyan's To Be a Pilgrim,
which, you know, is where
that's
probably
where
most
I'd heard it from. I suddenly found myself back at school.
There's wonderful clarity to the voices and the music. Is this also a way that then the lyrics have an importance?
I think certainly the way that Emily and Lucy, who actually sings at the start of that song, sing, then it is very much about the narrative and the story. And I know that they, when they recorded that song, it took them several takes to do it without crying.
It was funny listening to it. It was terribly, it had a real sadness to it, real melancholy, but at the same time, a very reassuring warmth around it. I was listening to it thinking, is music, I'm not going to say the F word now, I don't know what to call it, is it seasonal?
Very much so. I mean, traditional songs were always sung by people for different seasons. I mean, carols, I mean, that tune is used for the Sussex carol as well. And carols weren't just Christmassy, they were sung at Easter and all manner of different times of the year. So I think there's definitely an element in there.
Our next track, or your next track that you've brought to our attention, is Marit and Rona. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Marit and Rona, Marit is Swedish, but from Norway, and Rona is from the Highlands of Scotland, and she's a Gaelic singer and fiddle player, and Marit plays Lat Mandola, which is a kind of sort of mutation of a mandola. I've only just recently discovered these two, and they're absolutely incredible. The song I've chosen actually is very unrepresentative of their album, but I really like it. It's got a real kind of spirit to it.
Let's have a listen. That was Marit and Rona there. Tim Chipping, what language are they singing in this? It's a combination, isn't it? Well, and what are they singing about?
The first song is a traditional Swedish song that Marit's singing in, and the other is a traditional Gaelic Scottish song that Rona is singing. Na som flickorna is, I think, the Swedish, and Badach is the Gaelic. And there are two songs intertwining, one about girls and one about old men, apparently. The last line of the Gaelic song says, "The second old man said to the first old man, I will stick your head in the hearth."
Charming. It does have a sort of a robust approach to it, doesn't it? Because even if you don't understand what the lyrics are saying, you get a fair idea of what they're feeling.
Yes, I think that's why I chose it, because I think there is a tendency. I mean, we talked about the kind of, it's very soft beautifulness of the way that Emily sang in the first song, but there's a lack of really sort of gutsy traditional singing, I think, on the current scene, particularly with the Scottish singers, because BBC Alba is so big now, and there's a very particular kind of Alba sound, a very soft, kind of gentle, middle-of-the-road sound that people are going for. So I love the fact that this is really raw and gutsy and rah.
Is folk music a Northern Hemisphere kind of thing?
No. Every country has a traditional music, every country has traditional songs and dances. It's just some have kept them going. Some are in unbroken traditions. Some are like ours and like in Sweden, a tradition which died and then was revived. Some exploit it for tourist purposes. Others, like England, like to hide it with embarrassment. You know, but it's a tradition everywhere.
You mentioned that, do they like to hide it with embarrassment? Is that still the case? I mean, we joke about it, but...
Well, that is the fact that those jokes still exist, I think, that people can't sort of talk about English traditional music without sort of going tee-hee Morris dancing, as if Morris dancing isn't one of the most kind of vital and exciting things to watch when you see it done properly, because it is.
I wonder, we were talking about the seasonality of it. Is there a geographical specific element to folk music that you have to... It seems more rural than urban.
No, not really. No, there are plenty of great industrial songs and great work songs. You know, the traditional songs changed and they moved with the people, and as the people became industrialised, so did the songs.
Animal Heart is your next track, from an artist called Nina Persson. Tell us a little bit about Nina.
Not traditional at all, because I like pop music as well. And this is Nina, who was the singer in The Cardigans, who've been away for 8 years now.
Have they really?
Yeah. And so this is her first solo album. She took some time off to be a mum, and this is her first solo record.
Let's have a listen. Give us away. The moon is
And that was Nina Persson and Animal Heart from the album Animal Heart, which is out next year. Tim Chipping, it's nice to listen to a return to good songwriting. I always remember with the Cardigans, you always got really interesting and almost complicated pieces of music that were sold to you as pop songs. And it's nice to see that Nina Persson hasn't lost that. She's still got that real craft to her.
I think she's really one of the great writers and great voices of the last 20 years. And it's taken, I think it probably still isn't recognised, but I think it's taken a long time for that to be noticed, because I think her skill is hiding how clever she is under kind of very, very commercial sounding great tunes. But everything she does, it takes me a while to like it, but then I fall obsessively in love with it and play nothing but that record.
She always has a very sort of intimacy to her. I remember there's a story about her writing Love Fool, which was the great hit that the Cardigans had. She wrote it in an airport departure lounge. And the fact that she's now gone off and taken time off to devote to her family life, how much do you get the impression that her family life and her personal life actually is so much part of what she does professionally?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I've dwelt on her personal life that much, really. I know very little about her, which is strange. Most singers I like, I kind of obsess over and know, what make of underwear they have. But I don't know really anything about Nina.
Tell me, I'm curious. F-Roots, what is it?
It's a magazine that's been going for a very, very long time now. Originally called Southern Rag, to cover all manner of traditional music and music with some kind of feet in roots music. So for a while it was associated with world music, again another term which is kind of completely redundant now, but it's really the only magazine out there that really has that full breadth of kind of understanding the tradition and understanding how that exists in a kind of modern world.
And what format does it take in terms of your readership? Are you keeping print and are you keeping words on paper as much as you can?
I think absolutely. I think that's really important for Ian, the editor, that it's still a print magazine. I think that's what he still believes in and has that passion for print. But it is now available on electronic devices.
We shudder. Let's go to our last song. It's by Rant. And the track is called, what, Back at Home at Onsbecken. What
yes.
is this?
This is my favourite record of the year, I think. I'm so impressed with this. It's four of our best Scottish fiddle players. And this album was recorded in a church, a 1700-year-old church in Cromarty on the Black Isle, with just two microphones. So you can hear the building. The building becomes a fifth instrument. I just think it's beautiful.
Let's have a listen. Rant, Back at Home at Onsbecken there. The record of the year, no less, of Tim Chipping, our guest music reviewer today. Thanks for bringing that in, Tim. Tim, before we leave you and say goodbye and thank you very much for coming in, what will you be listening to at Christmas?
Well, that record, I think it sounds like Christmas Morning. I always play the Cocteau Twins' Treasure album, which wasn't made as a Christmas album, but I've noticed other people think of it of that as well. And of course, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, which is probably one of the most perfect Christmas records ever made. I don't know how she did it.
We'll leave it there. It's the first time you've ever heard an endorsement of Mariah Carey on Monocle 24. Thank you very much indeed, Tim Chipping, singer journalist with the monthly column in F Roots magazine. You're listening to The Review.
Next, we're moving out of the studio and travelling to this week's city of choice to get a feel for the cultural calendar in the days to come. Our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, has been busy scouring the listings of the Japanese capital to bring us this guide.
In Japan, most Christmas decorations come down on December the 25th to make way for New Year, the big celebration of the season. To catch the last of the festive atmosphere, head down to Omotesando to see the Christmas lights, or to Tokyo Midtown, where they have their annual light display. This year, there are 280,000 blue LEDs, making a vast starlight garden. Product design is an art form in Japan, where designers combine traditional craft and modern technology to create some of the simplest, most functional products on the market. For a roundup of contemporary product design, head to the Museum of Modern Art in Takebashi, where there is a group show by designers such as Makoto Koizumi and Masanori Oji, who might not be household names, but are responsible for a number of products used every day in Japan. For a quirky dose of art, take a break from shopping and go to the Shiseido Gallery in Ginza to see the last few days of a show by Yasumasa Morimura, one of Japan's leading artists. Morimura has made a name for himself with intriguing self-portraits that insert his face into iconic paintings and photographs. His latest series takes on Las Meninas, the classic depiction of 17th century Spanish royalty by Diego Velázquez. It isn't too difficult to spot Morimura. Looking ahead to January, when even sunny Tokyo can turn chilly, make your way to Setagaya Boroichi, a vintage market in Setagaya that's been held for the last 430 years. There are only two installments each year, and the next is on January the 15th and 16th. With over 700 stalls, you will need your strength. The traditional food at the event is daikan mochi, freshly made rice cakes. For Monocle in Tokyo, I'm Fiona Wilson.
Thanks, Fiona. From Tokyo, next we head south to Melbourne on The Review.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson.
We take a moment now to stop by one of the globe's bustling cultural capitals and sit down with a local figure who can sift through the busy cultural calendar to tell us what's pleasing the crowds where they are. Today, our Madrid correspondent, roaming far from his Spanish route, was in the Australian city of Melbourne. He visited the busy newsroom of The Age and sat down with the deputy cultural editor, Dewi Cook, to talk about a pair of popular exhibitions. And given the warm southern hemisphere hot weather, the conversation naturally turned on to New Year's Eve. Let's have a listen.
So most of our audience will be probably snug under a blanket or by a fireplace listening to this, but down in the southern hemisphere, the weather's warmer and there's a lot more on.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot on, and you could do loads out on the street. You know, we've got lots of sporting events on in Melbourne over this time of year, but it's for that reason, actually, that the National Gallery of Victoria, which is our state gallery here, wanted to put on this really big exhibition of contemporary art called Melbourne Now, and that runs until March, and it's pretty extraordinary, actually. It's a survey show of more than 400 artists, and it involves about 30 curators, and it crosses two sites. So the NGV has its main gallery, its international gallery on St Kilda Road, and its Australian gallery in Federation Square. And the exhibition pretty much takes over the whole thing. And you've got everything from artistic ping pong tables to really terrific kids' commissions, which most adults seem to enjoy just as much, where you can make jewellery, you can make paper shoes, you can play this peculiarly Melbourne game called Trugo, which was created by railway workers in the early 20th century. And most importantly, it's a really great snapshot of what the local contemporary art and design scene is. you know, some of my favourite pieces in it are this fantastic video work by an artist named Daniel Crooks, and he explores Melbourne's laneways, which are, you know, one of the city's more famous aspects, but he goes down laneways in the suburbs and he stitches all of his videos together so that you're actually travelling down one single laneway. And it's in this very kind of psychedelic, like a void, basically. It's like a secret garden that you just keep going through and it continues on and on.
It sounds like a bit of an ambitious job, though, capturing the entire contemporary art scene of a city over decades. How have they gone about doing that? Has it been quite successful in your eyes?
That was definitely the question on everybody's lips before it opened. You know, how could a single institution attempt to capture the variety and innovation and diversity of the Melbourne art scene? And Melbourne's a city that has a lot of galleries, both commercial and artist-run, you know, independent spaces. And in some ways, it looked like the NGV were picking, you know, the best of those or their choice of those. But actually, when you walk in there, they've really just thrown the doors open. And that's a pretty extraordinary, I think, thing for a state-run gallery to invite its independent artists into its spaces. And this is a gallery that, you know, would ordinarily host major blockbusters. So it's Winter Masterpieces Series, as they're called. Its winter blockbuster exhibition was about Monet's garden, and they had, you know, 60 plus works from the Musée Marmottan in Paris. So you've gone from having an impressionist master to having, like I say, ping pong tables in the foyer, or an architectural structure made of $3 IKEA bins. And that's just a really exciting kind of moment, I think, for artists. And a lot of the young artists that we've spoken to and we followed a number have just seen it as a really great opportunity. It doesn't replace that grassroots contemporary art design and performance scene that the city has always had, but it's the sort of first foray for a major institution to take a look at what's out there. And also the fact that they're acquiring some of the works has been a really exciting moment for those artists who perhaps never thought that they would be in the NGV collection. You know, if you're looking for another trip out of town but you don't want to commit to the festival sort of scene, there's a great little gallery in Bendigo. It's called the Bendigo Gallery. In the last few years, it's been really just drawing huge crowds for a regional gallery, because it's kind of carved a niche out for itself as a gallery that shows fashion. And they've got an exhibition on at the moment called Modern Love, which they've curated with FIDM in LA, which is the Fashion Institute's design museum there. And they've got a number of pretty beautiful pieces. So it's about this period in fashion in the 80s and 90s when designers like Alexander McQueen and Versace were really coming up, and they've got, you know, an Alexander McQueen dress that basically doesn't and shouldn't exist. It was made specifically for the FIDM Museum. It's based on a dress that was in the Harry Potter movie or something like that. But, you know, it's a really rare opportunity, I think, for Australian audiences to go see it, because the FIDM collection isn't always widely available, you know, for the public to visit, even if you were in LA. And yet this small little gallery in Bendigo has, I think it's more than 70 pieces, you know, including jackets that Linda Evangelista wore and all that kind of stuff. So it was the era of the supermodel, and I think anybody with an interest in fashion would probably get quite a lot out of it.
And just finally, perhaps even just to make the audience feel a little, the Northern Hemisphere audience, to feel a little envious at home, what will you be doing on New Year's?
Most likely, I say I'm probably going to go to the Edinburgh Gardens, which is a big, beautiful park in a neighbourhood called Fitzroy in Melbourne. And pretty much everyone in the city, or anyone that, you know, that I would know in the city, turns out there New Year's Eve and just has a party. And you have barbecues if you want, and if the night's warm, you know, things can get a bit crazy, but that's our plan. We tried to get there last year, but, you know, other party plans got in the way. And it's just a great place to be. It's a place that everybody goes, even if it's not New Year's Eve. There's nothing planned about it. It's just, it's just a wide tree and grassy space that people gather in, and pretty much it's do whatever you like, you know, and really lucky, I think, that neighbours are very accommodating. You know, Fitzroy's got a bit of a reputation. I've been to a lot of parties there where people just seem okay. You know, you take over public parks and neighbours will put their speakers out in the windows and join in for the most part. And I hope that, you know, you get enough of a critical mass of people, it makes it a bit difficult to stop that from happening.
Well, tolerant neighbours is one of the things we love at Monocle, so hopefully I'll see you at the park, because that's actually what my plan was going to be as well.
Oh, fantastic. You and me and 25,000 people, I'm sure.
That was Deputy Culture Editor of The Age, Dewi Cook, speaking with great pleasure to Liam Aldiss.
It's Saturday here in London, so you must be listening to The Review. Now, Art Basel Miami is a traditional point where three things mix: celebrity, art and luxury. And if this year's sales and attendance figures are anything to go by, that blend is as potent as ever. 70,000 people went this year. The galleries did well, by all accounts.
To make sense of the art fair that many believe still leads the way, we're joined by Francesca Gavin, a busy lady. Her work includes curating the likes of Soho House to being contributing editor at publications as wide-ranging as Harper's Bazaar France and Dazed and Confused. Francesca, welcome.
Hello.
So, Art Basel Miami, it really fits the city, doesn't it, in its nature?
Yes, definitely. And over the past sort of 5 years, I think it's increasingly become taken over by things like the fashion industry, events, parties. I mean, essentially, it's a lot of hedonism in the sunshine with art attached. However, what I really, because I haven't been to Miami intentionally for about 3 years.
How do you accidentally go to Miami?
Well,
we won't ask.
I'll put it this way, I've intentionally been avoiding going, because right. The last time I went, I was so aware that the art there had been so marginalized and was so tacky. Mm. It was kind of the most populist art. It was a little bit brasher, and definitely the crowd is a little bit brasher. But I really felt that this year that the work was intelligent and more engaged, and actually was attracting a really different audience outside of the whole party sort of circus that surrounds Miami at the same time.
I mean, there were great reports of the parties and the sponsorship deals that you were talking about that do dominate the scene. But how do you think that they managed to claw back the art to where it should be?
I think it's just simply a case of a lot of galleries were bringing smarter work and going, okay, this is who we are attracting and what we want to be engaging with. I mean, yes, there are some hilarious exhibitions outside of this. My personal favourite was the Ferrari-sponsored Venus Over Manhattan curated show at the Herzog & de Meuron car park, which was basically car art by Keith Haring and Cesar, alongside a whole floor of the most amazing Ferraris that people were driving. So that was the most ridiculous Miami experience.
For those of us who don't know as much about car art as we should, can you help us a little on that, please?
Well, I mean, it would be a case of artists kind of working on top of cars and making them into artworks or inserting things. I mean, it was kind of hilarious. It was trashy, but actually also really enjoyable. But only in Miami will you get people in, you know, Louboutin heels in a car park looking at artworks that have been painted on cars.
I mean, it is a bit like a set Miami. But what I found when I was there a couple of years ago interesting is that proximity to Latin America and how that influences so much. But also I found in the art fair, and I think for collectors, especially those coming from Europe, that must be quite exciting to see a sort of bit of a balance towards Latin American and South American art.
Well, I think we've definitely seen like a rise in abstraction in the past few years anyway. It's very noticeably in painting, but what I felt in Miami this year is that it had a much more sculptural feel. So both, for example, people like Ben Stansbury, who's showing at Cope Cebulski at NADA, there's an amazing artist I've noticed at Lister earlier this year called Radu Cosmo, who's from a gallery called Sabot in Cluj in Romania, and also a lot of artists showing at somewhere like Thomas Dane. They were kind of doing more concrete sculptural interpretation of abstraction, which definitely feeds into a Latin and South American kind of idea of that kind of heritage of conceptual art. So I definitely felt that there was a lot of that kind of serious work. And I was speaking to a couple of galleries, and a lot of those collectors have a really different engagement on how they buy work. And they're not all about coming midweek to the opening. It's a much more slow and steady relationship with collectors. It's sort of engaged throughout the week, and they come with their family. They really are a lot more outdoor work, a lot of sculpture. It was really interesting.
Who's buying it, Art Basel, Miami. London was full of Russians with just hoovering things up. It was astonishing. Fiac was French. Who now goes to Art Basel, Miami to shop?
I mean, there definitely is a lot of American collectors, and there's definitely a lot of South American collectors. You don't get the Russians, you don't get the Arabs, you don't get the Chinese in the same extent that you do here, which is why so many American galleries have been opening up in London over the past year and a half.
Of course.
But more than anything, I was really aware that there was a lot of critics and actually engaged people. And there was, I mean, I was really impressed by the European galleries and what they were bringing over there to sell and selling. Things like the Vilma Gold Charles Atlas installation, which I thought was totally museum worthy, which was a 5-screen installation called Martha, 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 so a tribute to Martha Graham, but incorporating edited footage from burlesque films, Lee Bowery footage, 1950s musicals, and it was really amazing seeing that in that context. And then there was Tanya Leighton's booth from Berlin, I thought was really impressive, which was half Oliver Laritch and half Alexandra Domanovich, who are actually a couple based in Berlin in real life. But that again had turquoise walls, and it was a really engaged, smart, kind of lively take on technology and its relationship to sculpture.
I think what's interesting is that a lot of the art fairs are, they're like circuses. They're in for a week and then they're out. And because a lot of collectors, very wealthy collectors, have started their own museums there, after the circus is gone, there still is quite an interesting art scene in Miami now, isn't there?
Well, the last time I was in Miami, I was curating the Soho House, the Soho Beach House, out there. And so I spent a lot of time in Miami off-season. It's a very different city off-season, shall I phrase it? There is an art scene there, particularly based around specific artists like Buzz Fisher International, which is Naomi Fisher, and partner Jim Drain. There's an artist, Bhakti Baxter, doing interesting stuff out there. There's a project spaces like Locust Projects. And there are some really good collections. There's some major collectors like the Dela Cruz and the Rebel. However, Miami is a very weird city. You can't get anywhere without a car. North Miami is one of the darkest places I've ever been. Don't go to Little Haiti. I mean, there is...
It's a little Miami Vice
there. It's not my favorite. Yeah, I mean, well, essentially, apart from being, let's say, the capital of Latin and South America in terms of financially, it's also the biggest money laundering center in America. So personally, I have tentative feelings about Miami. I'll phrase it that way.
Francesca Gavin.
Honest opinion.
On that note, thank you very much indeed. That was Francesca Gavin. With that, we must bring a close to our weekly review show. So it's goodbye from us here at Midori House. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
Next week on The Review, we'll be introducing a new book review segment and discussing the latest film releases with Tim Robey. But for now, get ready for The Curator, Monocle's Best of Radio Show, which pulls together the unmissable highlights from the week that was on Monocle 24.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Goodbye from us. Have a great weekend.